Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our class this evening. We have Brother Phil here with us this evening. He's going to lead us thoughts on Judah, Leader is Forged. And you read from Genesis chapter 38. I'm going to call forward Brother Phil.
Good evening, everyone, brothers and sisters, in the Lord Jesus Christ. Amazing to be with you tonight to consider this man Judah. That was a pretty heavy reading. It's probably one of the most heaviest in the whole Bible, isn't it? There's so much stuff in there, but it really helps us to understand that God is so real. He deals with real people, and this is a story of a man who changed by the things that happened to him. The things he went through changed this man from what we say in that chapter, and that was a turning point in his life, to someone who was so different when he came and gave that amazing heartfelt speech before Joseph. He was a totally changed man from the things he experienced. And I suppose that's maybe the take-home lesson tonight, is that what happens to us in our life happens to change us. Like, God is working in our life providentially because he has a plan with all of us in his eternal purpose, and the things that are happening to us are there to make us more like our Father and our Lord Jesus Christ. And that's really, in a nutshell, the story of Judah's redemption. Now, I've got a few handouts here. Wow, it was a good turnout tonight. I did 30 of these, so maybe hopefully there's enough to go around. It sort of helps me to get things in perspective a bit with Judah and the whole family. The front page has got key events in the life of Isaac, Israel or Jacob, and Joseph. Now, just if you cast your eye over that little legend down the bottom, it says events in the life of. So there's a pink life, which is Isaac's life. And then events in Jacob's life, which is the green line. And then events in Joseph's line, which is the green line. It's got some assumptive sort of ages, but the blocks with a number and the block around it is the confirmed age. So by a series of assumptions, we can sort of get an idea of who was alive when and the events that were happening around them. And I find that sort of helpful to understand that. For instance, it's interesting that Jacob was married to Rachel and Leah when he was 77 years old. Like, oh, I always thought, I was assumed he got married when he was younger, because Esau was married when he was 40. That's a long time, isn't it, between when Esau was married and had started to have children and when Jacob was married and given in marriage to Leah and then Rachel. So that was interesting for me to note. It was also interesting for me to note how quickly the children were born. The 12 boys or the 12 children were born pretty much in 7 years, like, given that they were four women who were giving birth. And what that meant, it meant that the boys, all of them except for Benjamin, who was born sometime later, you can see the birth of Benjamin there when Jacob was probably around about 100, was quite a bit later than when most of the other boys were born, between when Jacob was 84 to 90 years old. That's when 10 of the boys were born. Joseph a little bit towards the end of that. So that's interesting, isn't it? And it's interesting how long Isaac lives through that whole story. He lives right up through all the birth of the boys, the incident we read tonight with Judah and Tamar. He was still alive, and he died when he was 180, when Jacob was 120, and when Joseph was 30. And when Joseph was interpreting the dreams for Pharaoh, that's when Isaac died. So it sort of gives you a bit of an idea of that. Now, as always, feel free to chip in with any insights or comments about what you observe tonight, and I'll be obviously asking some leading questions, and that'll form the basis of most of the study class, really, is just exploring the things that we want to do together. So feel free to chip in. If you flip over the back of that, you'll see another little one, which has obviously got all the children from the different wives and handmaids. And there's a little one at the top there that says year one. Calculation begins from the first year of Jacob's marriage to Leah. So when remember Jacob was deceived and he was given Leah. The year one is when that child was born. So if you look at Leah, she had Reuben in year one, Simeon in year two, Levi in year three, Judah in year four. And if you skip across to Bilhah, you'll see that Rachel, remember, gave Jacob the hand servant. So she had Dan possibly in year three and Naphtali in year four. So you can see they were born, all these boys were born very close together, given the record. And then we see Leah's servant. Obviously, there's a period of, remember, Leah was made barren, like the Lord closed her womb, and that's the incident in when she conceives Issachar, which is in the sixth year. Remember, Reuben brought the mandrakes in from the field, and they did a swap, and Leah got to lie with Jacob, and that's when Issachar was born, and her womb was reopened. And then Zebulun year 7, Dinah year 7, Asher 6, and then Joseph in the 7th year. And Joseph was born, young when they moved out of Haran. Where were they staying? Jacob staying before he moved back in Haran, to Haran. So I think that's just sort of like a bit interesting to think about that. Is there anyone got any sort of comments or insights or thoughts from observing all that? That's right. She was very busy. Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's luckily they had so many servants and they all lived together, I think. That's a big family, isn't it? And it's a, as we'll see, it had complications. There were complications because there were so many, like, mums and so many kids from different mums. But all the same father, it got very complicated and caused a lot of problems. Yeah, that's right. And close together. Like when you think that Judah was probably only 4 years older than Joseph, in all reality, he was probably 21 when Joseph was 17. And obviously, remember, Benjamin Jacob calls him the son of my old age. So he was had a lot later, and obviously Rachel died giving birth to him, which was an absolute sorrow for Jacob. All right. Anyone else want to make any comments on that? it'll probably help as we go along. Okay, let's think about what was the family culture that shaped Judah as a young boy and young man. Let's think about his environment and influences on him that made him the kind of person that he was. Like, what was the family, what was this culture like that Judah was growing up with? Just think about back to what Jacob was like, what his life was like, what the tenor of his life was like, what was happening between Leah and Rachel. What were the things that shaped Judah and that family?
Survival.
Survival. Okay, let's start. I'll just run up these words in here. What do you mean by survival? Jacob was. He was. Well, they, in fact, they were all shepherds.
Sorry, are you talking about Jacob or Judah?
Judah, like the family culture.
Oh, yeah.
The family culture.
If you had many brothers, you would have to stick up for yourself to survive.
Yeah. So it was like, we can say it was very
competitive.
Absolutely. Survival, competitive.
I mean, everyone's working an angle, aren't they? Like, his dad's trying to do what he can to get wages out of his uncle, and then his uncle's trying to rip his dad off, so, like, there's all these schemes going on. And then, you know, his mum and his auntie have got schemes, and so everyone's sort of working an angle, trying to do something all around him.
So there's lots of manipulation, lots of scheming.
Quite adversarial.
There's a very strong language used. You know, Leah says, "My husband hates me. I'm not loved," and all that kind of thing. You know, so there's a lot happening. Adversarial. I'm really bad at writing. You know what I mean? Yep.
Jealousy.
Excellent. Absolute jealousy, and we'll see that come through between the wives, between the boys, you know, between Joseph and his brothers. Is a key thing of jealousy.
Favoritism.
That's right up there, I reckon. Favoritism. And where's the root of that in Jacob's family? That goes right back to who? Esau. Esau and Jacob. Yep.
I am. testing. Sorry about that. So favoritism is a really big one and comes through, and the effects of the children knowing that they're not loved as much as someone else or loved less. And the consequences of that favouritism just runs so deep. And we know, like, it's not hard to extrapolate that to our own experiences and to our own families. Favouritism is a really big one.
Because in that fear, I mean, you've got, like, when he was a young boy, there's all this fear about Esau, like, for two nights the whole family's afraid.
Yes.
And, he set out in front and, like, his younger brother's behind in another camel train so that they can dash off to be protected.
Yeah.
So, you know, you feel like we're part of the sacrificial part of the family.
Yeah, and that goes back to the favouritism. Remember the order that Jacob put them in? So he put all like Leah's kids first, and then all the handmaids first, and then last of all was Rachel and Joseph. Like, they were the most favoured position because, you know, hopefully by the time he got to them, he wouldn't hurt them, or they'd have more of a chance to escape. So that goes right back to how he dealt with Jacob. With Rachel and Joseph then, and everyone would have been patently obvious what he was doing.
There's also a culture of deceit too, which really started right back.
Yeah.
Religion as well, because
Yeah. Deceit is massive. And there's so much irony. Remember that goat, the goat thing? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, remember what Jacob used the goat in his deceit first up, and then the boys dipped the goat, the blood, the coat in the goat's blood, and then Judah with the goat. So there's this little theme running through about these people that were getting deceived, and that whole thing was just inherent in the family, that it was deceit and scheming was fair game. It's what you did to survive. And it was just like part of the culture.
But the amazing thing is underneath all that, they've got the promises. And I'm sure that their father talked about them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just such an irony, isn't it? And we'll see that's where Judah comes back to. I think Judah, at the end of the day, he remembered the promised seed. He remembered the promises. And I think he got with this Perez that maybe this is the promised seed. Like, it's such an unlikely birth, you know, one coming out before the other. We've seen this before, Jacob, Esau. Yeah, God's working still in our family, and maybe it is with me that this is going to happen, and I have to step up and I have to show leadership and responsibility. And I think that was part of the turning point in his life.
So I think for all that, there must have been talk about God in the family and the promises.
Yeah, which sort of comes to this favouritism a bit, like, does God have favourites? That was one of the questions. It's too big a subject to even deal with, but, you know, the whole point of Esau have I hated, Jacob have I loved, you know, we're God's promised people, like, we're above the law, we can do whatever we want almost because, you know, God's with us and he favours us, and despite whatever's going to happen, it's going to happen. I think that's another subject, but it's interesting in terms of the psychology of thinking that you are favoured by God and how that affects, like, your life, really, or your culture.
There was a loyalty amongst the family, so when you reflect on the episode with Donna, how she was abused, and then there was a marriage deal, and Levi and Simeon pretended that they were going to go out there and, you know,
yeah,
party and be the best man, and they
killed
everyone, made their names stick. So while they were loyal to each other and to their family, they were then also very isolated.
Tribalism, wasn't it, really? It's like...
Yeah, and there's like a culture there of payback too.
Yeah.
And it did seem to have... It seems that there is sort of misconduct, behavioural misconduct. You know, we've just read that episode with Judah.
Yeah.
Reuben is cursed by his dad in Genesis 49 for what he did.
Yes.
We've got this episode with this poor girl that was getting abused.
Yes.
The Wild West.
It was crazy. Yeah, it was so dysfunctional. Like, what for what God had called them to, you know, like through the oral tradition from Abraham and what he was calling them out to, you know, it was like God, it would have to take them down to Egypt to isolate them, or they would have totally destroyed themselves. It was like Joseph was the saviour. They had to be isolated in Egypt to maintain their identity, you know, because it was shocking. Like, you read that chapter tonight, and Tamar is the hero in that sense. She suffered so much abuse in terms of how she was treated, but it seems that she understood and received God's blessing and God's grace, and became a shining example, as did Ruth, of integrity and righteousness, and thus the line of Jesus comes through her. You know, to be able to survive, not only survive that, but to bring up Perez and that spiritual line and instill in them the knowledge, because it seems that it did come from her, is amazing.
In terms of dysfunction and stuff, and it all seems but also to not having one man and one woman married to each other, and the consequences of
disobeying God's
intention
and effort. Yeah. Yeah. Well said.
So you've covered up on all these, and these are just some quotes. Favoritism was right up there at the top of what the effects that has on children and people when they know, when they experience and when they see that they're not loved as much. Like, profound impact on people. And from that comes envy, the idea of envy, envious. Anger, manipulation, these are just examples of this in the family. We won't spend too much time on it. I don't know what I've done there, but it's not good. Hatred. Hate is such a strong word. Like, you look at the hatred that the brothers had for Joseph, 37. And some of this hatred is the enmity between the spirit and the flesh. There's no doubt about that. Like, Esau hated Jacob and Jacob hated Esau because they were differently aligned in terms of what they really drove them. Was it the flesh or was it God? So Joseph was hated because he was more spiritual than his brothers. There's no doubt. And he was loved by Jacob maybe for that. But there was just pure hatred because they were envious and didn't like him. Just as normal as people hate each other who aren't spiritual or less spiritual. Does that make sense? Jealousy. Competitive. Yeah, the whole incident about Reuben in chapter 35 is about who is the boss. Who is going to start throwing their weight around when Reuben went into... was it Bilhah, his father's handmaid or wife, really, or concubine? That was all about authority, birthright, stamping his authority on the family. It totally backfired on him because he lost his birthright because of that incident, as did Simeon and Levi over the incident with the killing all the Shechemites. And so it went to Judah. The blessing, the main blessing, did go to Judah because despite his failures, he did step up. We'll see. Deceit. Murderers. Like, murderers. And then greed. It's interesting that only Simeon and Levi go and murder them, and then all the brothers see all the stuff there, so they go and pinch it all and take the women and children and all the livestock. It's like... yeah, you guys do that, but yeah, we're going to get what we want. And they, I don't know what they did with all those people. They must have kept them all, you assume, and inculcated them in. Because later, when Jacob says, look, we're going to go up north to Bethel, get rid of all your idols. Because there was, like you said, there's idolatry in there as well. It's like they've broken all the Ten Commandments for the whole shooting match, you know. Yeah.
I think they were also court supporters.
You can't say that. You can't say that.
Thank you,
Lisa. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm thinking of the list in the New Testament, right?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of
emulations, hatred, jealousy. Sexual immorality, it's all there, isn't it? You know, it's staggering.
It's staggering that God works through that.
Yeah, God
promises to go through that family.
Yeah.
It's a total relief.
It is a total relief. And that's where, like, people say God does his best work when we are most sinful. Like, that's when his best work is done, because Judah ended up owning that and acknowledging it. He owned it. He said, you are right. This is what I am like. And it's not good enough. I've got to man up and I've got to change and I've got to take on my responsibilities. And from that moment on, he did. He did. And it's an incredible story. And it is an incredible story of God has come to save sinners, of who we are chief, and we need to own our sin, we need to confess our sin, we need to be transparent with God, and it's only by the grace of God. And that's, at the end of the day, it's a story of God's grace. At some point in time, I was trying to find where it might be, but Judah did forgive himself and was able to move on. And I think that's the challenging thing, isn't it? For Judah to be able to realise that despite all the bad things that he'd done, whether he was trying to work for his redemption, you know, like he thought Joseph was gone. He thought he had betrayed him and it was on his head. And when he spoke to, remember when he spoke to Joseph, he said, when one of them is dead, like he was convinced Joseph was dead and that was his fault. And he would have to live with that for the rest of his life. But he was trying to do what he could, yeah. Yeah, it's pretty out there, isn't it? Any further comments just on the other one before we move on? We will see good in Judah. Like his change is amazing, and his boys. And I think one of the most telling little phrases is it says, remember that whole incident with Joseph? It says, and the brothers all spoke together. Like when Joseph revealed himself to them, they all spoke together. It was probably the first time for a very long, long, long time that they had all just spoken openly and joyfully together as a group of grown-up men. But they'd been through so much to get there, you know.
It's a curious little observation in Hebrews 11 about Jacob, what his act of faith was. That wasn't that he prayed or read or brought up different children. In fact, it wasn't that he wrestled with an angel or communicated with God. It's at the very end of his life that his faithful act was to accurately assess and bless his children.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, so that leaning on his staff. And
interesting to think, where does Isaac fit into this family culture? Because when they went back to the land, they would have been, back when he was a teenager, I guess, they would have met up with Isaac again. He would have been part of that family. We know that at that time he'd already lost his sight before Jacob left, so he would have to be looked after, and it's like, you know, where did he fit in the boys' lives, and you know, did they spend any time with
their grandfather? Did he sit in the tent and not see anybody? Literally, or. Mm. It's a good point. Okay, what can we learn from Jude's part? So just back to chapter 37 in Genesis. What do we observe about Judah in this little section here? So picking up the record in about verse, verse 25. We know the story well. They sat down to eat bread. They lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels bearing spicery and balms and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. And Judah said unto his brothers, what profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. And his brethren were content. And then they passed by the Midianite merchant, and they drew and lifted up Joseph and gave him the 20 pieces of silver, and they brought them into Egypt. what does that little incident tell you about Judah? Remember, he's about 21 years old.
He didn't
want to
kill Joseph, did he?
He didn't really, did he? And in fact, he says, it's probably the only time where he says, he's our brother. He's our brother. And I think another version says, our own blood. Well, that conceal his blood remains our brother. He's actually our own blood. Yeah.
The NIV says flesh and blood. It's amazing how God works with people and also works to fulfill his will, because Joseph had to be kept alive because he was going to be the saviour for Egypt and Israel and the brothers and their salvation, and yet it was still their personal choice not to kill him.
Yeah.
So it all ties in together, doesn't it?
It's funny, Judah's here thinking, what advantage can we get out of this situation?
Mm.
And the advantage he thought he was getting out of the situation was those few pieces of silver from Selian, but the actual advantage he's getting from the situation is that Joseph was going to Egypt.
Yeah. God works in mysterious ways.
There are seeds of leadership there, though, isn't there, in verse 26. He's the one to speak. And
the brothers listened to him.
Mm.
They actually listened and respected what he said. They said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. It's interesting, Reuben, just like thinking about Reuben, like Reuben always had it in his mind he didn't want to kill him either. And he may have been thinking, I can use this as an opportunity to get back what I've lost. If I can save Joseph and prove that I saved him and bring him back to my father, then I might get back in the good books. And so he was appalled by the whole situation as well. Yeah, exactly. Which he would have. He was stitched him up.
And the irony is that he went out looking for them. You know, Jacob said, go out and see that they're okay, or that they're up to no good. And lo and behold, they got to no good.
Yeah, that's right.
The thing that always sticks out for me about chapter 37 is verse 2. Because it's hard up against chapter 36, which is like, this is the generations of Esau, and there's like all these people like following after Esau. And then you come to chapter 37, these are generations of Jacob, Joseph. That's it. It's all he's got. He hasn't made a choice yet.
Yeah.
And so, like, God's, you know, putting things hard up against them, like, you know, are you going to kill your brother, like, to try to get them to make a choice.
Yeah.
And they're still unwilling to make that choice to turn and serve God.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. That's really good. Yeah, the other boys aren't following the spirit of Abraham or the patriarchs, are they? In that sense, they've just totally gone off on a different tangent.
I mean, it's probably a bit, it's probably another night, because it's a bit of a tangent, but the boys going off to Shechem, and Joseph going to tell them, it seems, you remember that's where Jacob buried the idols when Rachel died. It seems like they were on an excavation expedition to dig them up again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they were marking with him.
Yeah. Joseph
turning up.
Yeah.
So they really hadn't made a choice about
whatever was going to be expedient.
In the first verse of that chapter, saying that the contrast between Jacob and his own children is that he was a stranger in the way of Canaan. So he definitely made his choice.
Yeah, that's a good point, eh? That stands out. That really does stand out. Yeah, and that's where we'll say, you know, like moving on, because it's time. We covered this. So moving on to chapter 38, which we read tonight, which is the next, a whole chapter devoted to Judah, and obviously it's in stark contrast with Joseph and the way he dealt with the situation in chapter 39. It's just like, bang, these are so obviously different brothers.
and how they lived their lives and the choices they made is so stark, and it's put in there for that. But it's also put in there to show the change in Judah, and to show that the promised seed would come through him as well. Why do you reckon Judah separated himself from his family? It says in verse 1, and it came to pass at that time that Judah went down from his brethren and turned into a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. And Judah there saw a daughter of a certain Canaanite. Why do you think Judah decided to separate himself from all his brothers and his family? Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think he couldn't. I think he could live with seeing the impact of what he'd done every day. He had to run away from it in that sense. His guilt. Yeah. I think that's right. I think he probably even thought, I just want to get away from it all. Like all this fighting, all this. Problem, all these issues, it's just too hard. I just want to start somewhere new. Maybe I can start a new family and just separate myself from this whole thing, get away from it all. It's exactly what he did. He went down and he got a wife and starved again. Let's just make a list of the bad choices. Try and do it chronologically that Judah made in this chapter. What are the bad choices that he made?
He felt running away with some of his problems.
Yep. Yep.
Married an Adullamite.
Yep. So he married out of the faith. He was getting... Absolutely. He was friends. Friend of the Canaanites. And you could tell this guy wasn't a very good friend. Like, when he said, look, I've used a prostitute, go and pay her. The guy had no qualms. Oh, yeah, whatever. Yeah, that's something we do all the time. No drama.
Can we make the assumption he didn't restrain his children in any way?
Yeah.
So he certainly ran, his boys certainly ran wild.
Both. We don't know why the first one was killed, but it says he was wicked and the Lord took his life. We got no reason why. But we know that he didn't pull up the second son when he wasn't fulfilling his duty as well, and that probably would have been pretty obvious. Yeah, anything else?
He was superstitious. He didn't want to give the youngest kid because he'd ashamed his boy.
Yeah.
So I'm so afraid of God.
Yeah. It's so ironic, isn't it? He thought Tamar was cursed and he was the one that was cursed. Like, God's trying to show him where the problem is, and he thinks this woman's got the issue. If we keep the boys away from her, it'll be alright.
He wasn't true to his word. He wasn't honest,
because
he said, you know, you're going to have my son and he's older. And
deceitful.
He might be one of those parents who always think the son should be their
children. Yeah.
You know, and it's always
someone else's fault. Yeah. Deceitful. Untrustworthy. Like, Tamar knows what he's like. He said, I'll send you a sheep. Oh, yeah. Will you? Give me something more. Yeah. Untrustworthy.
I've done it later.
Yeah. He was lustful. Like the sexual immorality, just straight out there. Sexually immoral.
And yeah, he was quite happy to have the tamer brought out and killed.
Yeah, that's just like, how would you describe that attitude? What would that be? Hypocritical.
Yeah, and he was also putting his immorality onto his sons as well. He wasn't teaching his sons any different.
Yeah.
He was expecting them to be the same way.
Yeah. Hypocritical, just like without compassion, like just so. Well, when he said, "Just bring her out and burn her," like that is just out there, isn't it? Just totally unfeeling.
A bit like the woman that brought out adultery. I mean, where's the man?
Hmm.
You know, she brought out for everybody.
Total double standard.
He's very worried about how he would be deceived, though, and this would have solved the problem.
Yes.
And that's referenced in verse 23 when he says, "I don't keep the things as their own, or we shall be loved."
Yeah. So he's really about self, his reputation is important at all costs.
His reputation to people, not to God.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why he wanted to kill Tamar, because of his reputation.
Like,
she would make him look bad being pregnant.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. They're a bad reflection on his family.
Yeah, but he doesn't know that.
But even so, the fact that she's pregnant and she's related, like the sister-in-law, like his daughter-in-law, is enough to make him feel, well, I don't want that in my family.
It's also pretty harsh to say to burn a woman who's got children.
A children.
Because, even...
No empathy. Like, seriously, just almost like what do you call those people that are
sociopath?
Yeah.
The thing that's always interesting to me from this chapter is at this point, like, I guess God knows the end from the beginning, but his son is a chip off the old block where he wants all the privileges but none of the responsibility. So he's happy to sleep with his son, his brother's, dead brother's wife,
yeah,
and enjoy that, but he doesn't want to actually have to pay for his brother's son's kids to go to school and whatever, so he's not going to have any.
Like, yeah.
So, but that's Judah at this point too.
Mm.
Yet God said, you know what, that son, that's it, that's all he's ever going to be.
Mm.
And that's the end of him.
Yeah. And he died as well.
But with Judah, God's merciful because he knows, obviously, even at that point, he's the same character.
Mm. Yeah, it's a pretty heavy thing, and you've put them all there. What does Judah lose in this chapter? What's he lose? Yeah? What does he lose? Respect. Self-respect. He loses self-respect. What else does he lose?
Two sons.
He's lost his wife. So he's had two boys die. His wife's died. He's lost, like, and you're thinking exactly how I thought. He's lost his self-respect. He's lost his dignity. He's losing everything. He's lost everything, hasn't he, at the end of the day? He's lost it.
But it could be a self-destructive thing where he felt that's what he deserved because of what he'd done with his deceiving his father and his brother.
It'd be very interesting to talk to him in
the kingdom. Absolutely, eh? For him to meet Jesus, the Lion of the tribe of Judah,
and to see the transformation that he went through, because at the end of the day, his speech, which we'll read just in a few minutes, is staggering. It's a different man. It's a different man than this man. But this is where he was broken. This was where God, like, brought him to rock bottom. He's lost two children. So he understands, he's starting to get empathy, what it means to lose a child. You think he can understand now how Jacob feels. He's lost two boys. He's lost his wife. He can understand how Jacob, and he loved his wife. Like, he's lost his wife. And the things that he's done in losing his self-respect, his dignity and everything, the point came when she said, "Whose are these?" And he said, he was honest for the first time in his life. He said, "They're my things. I did wrong. You are more righteous than I." That was it. And how would have he felt, you know, in that whole situation? He had nothing. Yeah. Yeah. I reckon she'll be an amazing person to talk to in the kingdom as well. Like, to be a Gentile woman who, like, loved, like, obviously understood enough of what Judah and his family were like, where they were from, their story, that whole thing, to really want children. Obviously, in that culture, children were very important. And to have been deceived out of that. But whatever drove her to do what she did, it was amazing faith. It's amazing faith, really.
Should Judah have married her? Just throwing that out.
Yeah, it says that he never knew her again, did he? So he never had relations.
But I just wonder whether he should have known.
Is there any record of Judah being married again or having any more children? I don't think there is. Maybe he never had another wife or woman again. That'd be an interesting thought. There's no record of him having, because in all the genealogies it's Judah, then it goes to Perez from Tamar. I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't, you know. Because of the experiences he went through. What does Judah gain? He gains the ability to, I think, to feel for other people. To understand what his father was going through and what his father was feeling. Before that, he had no idea. And that's so true, isn't it? Like, we empathise with people when we've been through things that they have been through, or they've been through things that we've been through. Like Paul says in Corinthians, the comfort that we receive from what we've been through, we can comfort one another. And life teaches us that. To be empathetic, to understand, to be compassionate with people, to treat people gently and kindly. Because we don't know what their story is. We don't know what people's story is. You know, like, Tamar's story will be amazing when we listen to it. And he gained the promised seed. Like, those promises, I think that's what he held on to. I think that's what he understood. That the promised seed would come through his family, because that's the way God did it.
It's interesting, remember when they were born, Zerah put his arm out first and they tied the red string on it. That's like so Esau and Jacob, isn't it? The red, symbol of flesh. And then the other one comes out first. Perez means the breach. And Judah must have known, like he understood about Esau and Jacob and the twins and all that kind of thing. It would have been obvious to him, I think, that this was the child of promise because it was so unnatural, and that's the way God works. And that's in Ruth, you know. May your family be like that of Perez because they were blessed. Because of, I believe, Tamar's faithfulness, the way she understood the promises and brought those kids up. From then on.
I think the red cord speaks of redemption, doesn't it? And we had it with Rahab with the red cord.
True. Yeah. Yeah, okay.
It obviously granted him returning to his family.
Mm.
And he obviously took them with him.
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe Tamar went with him, but
I reckon that's what happened. Because the next chapter says they were all up there. Like when the famine was there, all the boys were there, and it was Judah who said, like, we've got to take this in hand, let's go down there.
Yeah, the chronology is not easy. I'm not sure whether it's linear, because he should have been a grandfather at this stage, he's more Judah. So he's married when he's 21, first baby at 22, next one 23, 24, let's say. And he's waited for his younger son to be old enough to marry. He's at least mid-40s.
Mm.
So that would mean Joseph has been in Egypt for 24 years.
Mm.
So the chronology is, because it tells us about the children, it might even be quite late as
well. Yeah. I'm just looking back at that thing to see. They got Judah and Tamar. That sounds really loud. It's got Judah and Tamar when Joseph is like between, yeah, when Joseph and Potiphar's wife. So, yeah, I'm not sure how that all works. Yeah, because that is. He would have had to have had children and grown up really quick, wouldn't they?
I mean, even if we're being generous, Judah would have to be 40.
Yeah.
And that would be quite ridiculous.
Yeah.
But then he's marrying off his son as his mid-teenager.
Hmm. Yeah, good question.
So then the next question is, was the speech very opposed?
Which speech?
The comment he made
down in Egypt. Yeah, okay. So they're saying, yeah.
Sorry, just
for
a minute.
Yeah.
Well, it was 40 years from when they sold Joseph to they saw him again, so there is enough time.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, that's true. All right. Let's just read chapter 44, verse 12 to 34, because this is really jumping ahead. 44, verse 12 to 34. Sorry, it's 45, isn't it? Where am I?
44, verse
18. Verse 18, thank you. Maybe we'll read from verse 18 to verse 34. Would you mind reading that for us, James?
Then Judah went up to him and said, "Oh, my Lord, please let your servant speak a word in my Lord's ears, and let not your anger burn against your servant, for you are like Pharaoh himself. My Lord asked his servant, saying, have you a father or a brother? And we said to my Lord, we have a father, an old man, and a young brother, the child of his old age. His brother is dead, and he alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him. Then you said to your servants, bring him down to me that I may set my eyes on him. We said to my Lord, the boy cannot leave his father. For he should leave his father would die. Then you said to your servants, unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you shall not see my face again. When we went back to your servant, my father, we told him the words of my Lord. And when our father said, go again, buy us a little food, we said, we cannot go down. If our youngest brother goes with us, then we will go down. But we cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. Then your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons. One left me. And I said, surely he has been torn to pieces. And I've never seen him since. If you take this one also from me, and harm happens to him, you will bring down my grey hairs in evil to Sheol. Now therefore, as soon as I come to see your servant, my father, and the boy is not with us, then as his life is bound up in the boy's life, as soon as he sees that the boy is not with us, he will die. And your servant will bring down the grey hairs of your servant, our father, with sorrow to Sheol. For your servant became a pledge of safety for the boy to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father all my life. Now therefore, please, let your servant remain instead of the boy, as a servant to my Lord, and let the boy go back with his brothers. For how can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? I fear to see the evil that would find my father.
And Joseph could not refrain himself before all of them that stood by him. Like in the light of Judah's amazing speech where he tells the truth. You know, this is what you said, this is what we said, this is what you said, this is what we said. I've gone a surety. I know what will be the effect on my father. He's just a transformed man, isn't it? He's willing to give up his life. He's willing to give up his life, his whole existence in self-sacrifice that Benjamin might be saved and his father be spared any further grief.
And that's what Joseph was
doing. Totally. Totally, eh?
It's interesting. Four times that Joseph wept. I know people express themselves in different ways, but he's definitely in touch with emotions. And I don't know, correct if I'm wrong, but there's no physical outward sign. There's no doubt they repent and they change people's brothers, but there's no expressing emotion in tears, which is the depth of Joseph's love, which is a mirror of Jesus, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, and the whole purpose was that, you know, God was saving people. God is still about saving people. Like, he sent Joseph down there to save his family. And what Judah went through in his life was to save him, was to develop in him a character which was humble and which loved his brothers and which was willing to give up his life. You know, he lost everything, but he gained everything because of the journey he'd been on. It's a tremendous story, isn't it, of his. We've only really just scratched the surface of it. It's interesting when they all come back into the land, it's Judah who goes ahead of all the brothers to meet Joseph. Like Jacob sends him ahead, he is now the designated leader of the family. And amazingly, the blessings in chapter 49 are turned around. And remember that the brothers would all bow down to Joseph. Well, in Jacob's blessings, and this is where, you know, through the Spirit of God, he says to Judah, "Your father's son shall bow down before you. King will come from you, the Messiah." That's through the line through Jesus came. You know, Son of Man, Son of God, Son of Man. Jesus understands our frailty. He understands our weakness, our sin, our humanity. And he ever lives to make intercession for us. The story is, no matter what we've been through, no matter what we've done, there is redemption, there is forgiveness, there is grace. The promises are there for us to take hold of and to live lives of promise. Well, no, that's it. Thanks, everyone.